got a sprain.
Welcome to another edition of the Hey Doc Show. Harold Lasky is both the medical director and a physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida, and will be your host for the next half hour. With him is his lovely wife Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT and X-ray tech. Together, they hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining.
Today, Dr. Lasky and I are going to discuss new research in pain management. Just this week, Alicia Agnoli, a physician at the University of California, reported in the Journal of the American Medical Association that the opioid tapering that is being carried out by many doctors across the country at the suggestion of the Center for Disease Control carries significant risk, including a marked rise in overdose from narcotics and mental health crises such as depression, anxiety, and suicide attempts.
But before we even begin to go more into depth on this article, a little history is needed. By that I mean the history of pain management. Pain is universally good and bad. It's both useful as well as feared and hated. Maybe we should go back to our animal roots. A lion cub tries to grab a porcupine. It immediately feels pain such that it opens its mouth and quickly lets the animal free. The pain not only helped save it from further damage, but it also taught the lion cub to leave that animal alone in the future.
As a child, many of us have touched something hot. Perhaps your mom told you not to lean on the stove because you would get burned. But you may not have taken her seriously until those fingers felt the burn. It is a good chance that you never did that again, at least intentionally.
As a matter of fact, you probably thought about that burn, at least in your subconscious, whenever you came upon anything hot that could burn you and maybe even cause permanent damage. Pain teaches us to avoid fire, poison, sharp objects, and many other things that could cause us harm. It not only alerts our bodies to injury, but to disease as well. Just listen to the top 10 reasons that you may visit your primary care health provider. These top 10 reasons include asthma, bronchitis, sinusitis, and other acute infections, hypertension, or high blood pressure.
It also includes diabetes, metabolic diseases, and immunity disorders, as well as musculoskeletal problems such as joint disorders, osteoarthritis, and rheumatism.
Also, nervous system and sense organs, which are affected with ear infections, migraines, and pink eye, urinary tract and bladder infections, as well as menstruation disorders and menopausal issues. And finally, mental disorders, which includes attention deficit disorder, depression, and anxiety.
There are still more: injury and poison, contusion or bruises, sprains, strains, and open wounds, cellulitis with bacterial infection of the skin and tissue beneath the skin and abscesses, not to mention infectious and parasitic diseases.
Many, if not most, of these problems include the initial symptom of pain. The three most common symptoms for doctor's visits, in fact, were skin ailments, joint disorders, and back pain.
The topic of pain management has been much discussed in medicine of late because of the so-called opioid crisis.
Really early on, in fact, from ancient times right through the present, numerous civilizations and scholars have performed craniotomy in attempts to treat headache, hence the holes that have been found in buried skulls, showing the use of trepanation, that is, the cutting of holes through the skin, scalp, and the bone of the skull itself, to get rid of the evil spirits within. But let's travel back in time to the days of the caveman. Were cavemen impervious to pain?
It is unbelievable, but researchers have identified some genetic changes in modern humans that were present in many Neanderthals. This was a gene called a sodium channel gene.
The genes encode a protein called NaV1.7. This gene is necessary for impulse generation and conduction in the peripheral pathways of pain. The full Neanderthal variant of this gene, called a gain of function mutation, may lead to heightened pain sensitivity in present-day people. And to go even further, that is, on the molecular level, the Neanderthal ion channel is more easily activated, which may explain why people who inherited it have a lowered pain threshold. In other words, they feel more pain.
Whether Neanderthals actually experience more pain is difficult to know. But additional research suggests that threshold for initiating pain impulses was lower than in most modern humans.
The translation of pain input from peripheral nerves to consciousness involves the spinal cord and brain, which was likely more primitive in Neanderthals. So the heightened sensitivity to stimuli in the Neanderthal was actually a good thing. It worked as a protective mechanism.
Now let's go forward to the 1600s, where many European doctors gave their patients opium to relieve pain. By the 1800s, ether and chloroform were introduced as anesthetics for surgery.
Nevertheless, some doctors were actually concerned about the ethics of operating on unconscious patients. Even others suggested that relieving pain might hamper the healing process.
But most surgeons wanted to perform longer and more complex procedures, so for them, anesthesia was a divine blessing, as one researcher put it.
Looking back to the time of Napoleon is the mastectomy performed on Francis Burney in 1811. The procedure was performed, again, remember, without any anesthesia, with the knife actually plunged into the breast, cutting through veins, arteries, and nerves. She actually recounted later on in her memoirs that she began to scream that lasted unremittingly during the entire time of the incision. She fainted twice during the operation, but she was lucky. She survived and went on to live for another 29 years. Luckily, in the 1900s, morphine and heroin came into use as pain medications.
So, it was the start of doctors being torn between wanting to improve the quality of their patients' lives while fearing the treatment would make people vulnerable to addiction.
Initially, pain was, well, mostly considered a problem to manage in acute care, such as in injuries or post-surgical, or even during a painful death from cancer. And other patients complaining of pain were often regarded as deluded or were condemned as malingerers or drug abusers.
So, patients who didn't want to use drugs or couldn't access them turned to psychotherapy or were referred for neurosurgery.
In fact, even today, chronic pain is still one of the most difficult conditions to treat. First of all, pain is very individual. The only way to tell if someone is truly in pain is to ask them.
Many have, over the years, and even to this day, said that pain is in your head. In one way it is, but not the way that these persons are stating.
Let me give you an example. You step on a nail. Now, this evokes a local pain response in the foot, but your feeling of the pain comes a bit later as the signal travels through a nerve to the spine, where another nerve carries the pain signal to somewhere in the brain. These pain signals go along with the emotional and cognitive information, so as people develop pain conditions, they become anxious. That anxiety reinforces the pain signals.
The formation of pain as a field of medicine with its own dedicated journal called, appropriately, Pain, did not even occur until the 1970s.
Even today, we still find treatment of pain as being expensive, as the cost of those who treat the pain is very often not covered by health care plans.
Insurance is simply not set up to cover multiple visits at once with several doctors for the same condition.
After all, this is an additional cost to the insurance companies. And with chronic pain so high on the list of reasons that persons go to see physicians, these costs could really cut into the healthcare insurance companies' profits.
It was in the 1980s when several prominent pain specialists suggested there was a low incidence of addictive behavior associated with opioids, and the push was to more aggressively treat the chronic long-term pain with increased use of the drug.
Many believe that at this point there began a 20-year campaign backed by the pharmaceutical industry to increase the amount of the opioids in the treatment of pain.
Chronic pain can make it feel as if it is impossible to live your life, since you can lose so much quality of life.
And this leads to the new research that we started to talk about at the beginning of the show, where people on stable opioid therapy whose doses were tapered had significantly higher rates of overdose and mental health crises than people who did not have dose reductions. And that was done in a retrospective study.
In the study, those with tapered doses were more likely to have claims data for overdose and a composite of acute episodes of depression, anxiety, and even suicidal behavior.
Remember that there have been, over the past several years, changes in the way many physicians treat those with chronic pain, and many patients who were taking stable doses of opioids for chronic pain have had their doses reduced or tapered.
The study showed that for every 100 patients followed for 1 year, tapering was associated with about 4 additional patients having an overdose event and 4 additional patients having a mental health crisis event.
And the study only included those seen at hospitals and emergency rooms. So this could represent just the tip of the iceberg, with many more being left out of the number of patients who actually are suffering with the tapering.
Considering the new evidence, the question is really, is there more risk of morbidity and mortality in this group due to the tapering?
Is this just another example of balancing risk and benefit? In other words, should we be considering tapering? And if so, to what degree and what protocol to best serve these patients with long-term chronic pain? Many of those suggesting tapering have adamantly stated that this procedure is not meant for those with active cancer.
Unfortunately, studies show that many physicians are going beyond the suggested tapering and including even this group of suffering patients in the tapering regimen.
So what we really need, as the patient's response to opioid tapering varies widely, new methods and physicians that attend to the needs of the individual patient with chronic pain. It therefore should become universally accepted that any policy mandates to taper at a specified rate, to a specified dose, or to never go backwards will necessarily expose some patients to new health risks.
Any tapering should be a decision of both the physician and the patient. There must be very clear conversations between both concerning the potential risks and any additional individual risks that might be present. You may be wondering, how is it that those whose opioid drugs have been tapered to lower doses would then suffer from overdoses? The sad reality is that many of those whose doses were lowered simply did not or would not suffer from the increased pain due to the lowering of their medications. These individuals often then obtain the medications on the street, often getting more than they bargained for. The street meds often contain fentanyl, a very powerful narcotic which led these persons into the overdose.
Now, this does not mean that tapering would not be beneficial to some. It's important to also consider potential benefits of opioid tapering as well. However, and we have to again mention this, is that there may be a population for whom tapering leads to a significant physical adverse effect, such as opioid withdrawal or increased pain, as well as psychological stress, and therefore tapering must be reconsidered and possibly reversed in individual cases.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. Dr. Lasky has been the director and physician at the care center for over 34 years. They are located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just 2 blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection, between the Tulsa Welding School and the old Pottsburg Post Office. They will treat your pain, sprains, and strains. Dr. Lasky and Carmen are proud to welcome Dr. Pollan, M.D., a board-certified pain management physician, to the practice. The office emphasizes the treatment of chronic pain. They also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any question about Southside Medical Center, please call their office at 641-4411. That's Southside Medical Center, where your health is their primary care.
Now, with the time left, we'd like to explain the use, or maybe a better term is to demystify, the use in our body of the cannabinoids. Now, if I were to tell my parents that I was studying the endocannabinoid system of our bodies, they'd probably have looked at me mystified and told me to go at it, having no idea that what I was talking about was the effects it had on our bodies. Had I used the term pot or the term marijuana, they would have been aghast. Not my son! Exclamation point.
Nevertheless, a lot has changed over 60 years, not only in our acceptance of the substance, but in its use as a medicinal product.
I can just see my mom, had I been smoking weed and smelling it in the air, asking me what I was doing and then telling me, "It's okay, Mom, I'm taking it for medicinal purposes." Well, that wasn't going to happen, at least in the 1960s era. But now, things are different.
We now know a lot more about the chemicals in marijuana and what they can do for us.
So now is the time to start talking medically about cannabis so that you can understand just how it works in your body. To do this, I'm first going to tell you about an experience that you might have had in the past. For whatever reason, you're walking home after a nice dinner. It's dark, and as you walk to your car, you see a rough-looking guy step between you and your car.
A situation is occurring. Your body knows, or better yet, your brain knows that you have to make a decision right now and fast. Do you run or do you fight?
Lickety-split, your brain starts thinking, but it also subconsciously creates a chemical called adrenaline. Many call it the fight or flight hormone. As this hormone goes through your bloodstream, it sets up various activities. Your heart starts to pump faster and harder. Your muscles tighten, ready for that fight or flight. It also sends signals to your digestive system, basically telling it to stop digesting and use the energy for more useful activities in this fight and flight mode.
The adrenaline sort of acts like a key to many locks. It helps many organs to do things. You may start to breathe more rapidly.
But we're not here today to talk about your choice of fight or flight and the adrenaline system. We want to talk about what is called the endocannabinoid system. Now, this is the system that is triggered by the various cannabis chemicals found in marijuana.
This endocannabinoid system responds to certain things in your environment, as do many of our hormonal systems.
You may be assuming that this system comes into being later in life, perhaps during the teenage years. Nope, it actually is present in the fetus even before birth.
It is known to be important in the development of your brain. This includes the development of synapses in the body.
Remember that we talked about synapses last week when talking about how the body transmits signals from one nerve to the other? There are really no direct connections, as the end of one nerve and the beginning of the next are in an area that's called the synapse, where chemicals that are stimulated at one end of a nerve to stimulate a new nerve impulse down the next nerve, and so on until the signal reaches its ultimate destination.
We also talked about pruning, which is a part of brain development, where certain nerves' connections are removed if they are no longer needed.
There are basically two endocannabinoids that are produced in your brain. Now, these act on areas called cannabinoid receptors, just like the adrenaline works on adrenergic receptors. By the way, these two chemicals have very complex names. They are CB1 and CB2.
It's easy to see why the body makes adrenaline. It is a protective chemical in response to many stimuli.
Now, you may be asking yourself, why does the body make these cannabinoids?
What is the production responding to?
Well, the body produces these in response to things like exercise, stress, and pain relief, as well as anxiety and hunger. It can even increase or decrease depending on the time of day. So they're involved in appetite stimulation when your body senses that it's hungry.
When there is stress or anxiety, they are secreted in response to those stimuli.
They also increase in response to pain in certain parts of your body.
Now, here is a fun fact. Endocannabinoids go up almost 50% when you sing or dance.
Let's take just one example of the response where cannabinoids are increased. Suppose that you're having a stressful moment. Your body produces extra endocannabinoids. This increases the secretion of what is often called the stress hormone, which is cortisol. This cortisol then circulates in your bloodstream along with the increased endocannabinoids.
Apparently, the body learns from stress. So when you again are stressed out, the endocannabinoid levels increases even more than do the cortisol levels.
As a matter of fact, over time, there is less cortisol being produced with each stress situation, but more endocannabinoids leading the response. Over time, our brains form memories of many events, and it sees that the endocannabinoids are involved in this process. There's a part of the brain called the hippocampus, which happens to have a lot of endocannabinoids associated with it.
The endocannabinoids aid in the formation of helpful memories and assist in certain types of memories like remembering dates, names, and other types of lists.
But they also hinder the formation of harmful memories, like things that may be traumatic. They do this by preventing the consolidation and retrieval of the emotionally adverse memories. And so far, we've only been talking about the endocannabinoidal system that is located in our bodies. How about cannabis, as in pot or weed? What can it do for us?
First of all, there are two types of cannabinoids, tetrahydrocannabinol and cannabidiols, better known as THC and CBD.
But for this show, you're probably more interested in knowing about the THC. And so with the little time left for us, we will concentrate on that. Now, if you'd like to hear more about the uses of CBD, please drop us a line at our email address, livelonger@gmail.com. That's livelonger@gmail.com.
Remember that we said that the endocannabinoids act as a key, which fits into certain receptors or locks in the body.
Well, the THC fits into these same areas.
But what happens when it does this? Does it act just like the body's own endocannabinoid?
It can mimic them in some cases, or it disrupts the system. Remember that there are over 100 molecules in cannabis that are similar.
So, you may be asking, why are these specific molecules in nature in plants to begin with?
Well, you really have to think more in statistics and probability. There are probably thousands, if not millions, of chemicals in various plants. Statistically, you will probably find certain chemicals in certain plants that are similar enough to chemicals in our own bodies to create a reaction in the human body.
This is not an uncommon occurrence. Think of morphine that is present in poppy seeds. This molecule fits in perfectly to opioid receptors and is used in pain relief.
Or think of the chemical digitalis that is used to treat congestive heart failure and heart rhythms like atrial arrhythmias. This is available in the plant foxglove, a major export of Canada. So let's get down to more specifics on the effect of THC on the endocannabinoid system.
So there are two competing sources for the endocannabinoid receptors, the body's own endocannabinoids and the THC from plants that has been introduced into the system.
There are what we call fail-safe systems in our bodies which prevent it from being over-affected by certain chemicals and becoming dysfunctional. So the body then does something called down-regulating, and this is what happens when THC is in our system.
The body reacts by producing less endocannabinoids and less receptors. This means that over time, the body must obtain higher levels of THC to obtain the same effect.
Now, in response to stress, many take THC, and this helps them manage stress. However, in some people, there is the opposite effect, and it really causes anxiety. The problem is that with the increase in external THC, the body, which has been downregulated, produces less endocannabinoids on its own. Therefore, in this case, the body is not learning from the stressful event.
So there has been the question of whether there is addiction occurring in some people who take THC into their bodies on a more regular basis.
What we do know is that what is more likely to occur is something called dependence, since with less THC entering and the endocannabinoids being downregulated, the body does not have enough of the endocannabinoids being produced to cope.
So it is easy to see why THC can both stress and distress, affect memory positively or negatively, and make one sleepy or cause insomnia.
And as many people know, THC can make one hungry. In some cases, it actually decreases the appetite. And finally, on the downside, it can increase the risk of schizophrenia and depression in individuals that may be vulnerable. Of course, this depends a lot on the dose and the individual. Yin yang, good bad, risk versus benefit. Everything has to be taken into account.
We would like you our listeners to know that Dr. Lasky is one of only a few physicians in the Jacksonville area that has been certified to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. For more information, you can call their office at 641-4411. They have also set up a special website at www.compassionateforjacks.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. Unfortunately, we have come to the end of another Hey Doc show.